Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Primal Potential Podcast. I am Elizabeth Benton, and I never imagined that I would have to record this episode. And I just want to start by saying that this is going to be a really hard one. It's going to be a hard one for me. It is probably going to be a really hard one for everybody who listens. And I wish more than anything that I didn't have to record this. If you are emotionally not in a good place, if you have experienced infant loss or child loss, this might be a good one to skip. If you are new to the show, please, this is not representative of our normal material, but most of you guys know that a few days ago, I shared our daughter's beautiful birth story, never imagining that a week later, not even a week later, we would be letting you know that we lost her. I have Chris here with me. Hey, babe.
Hi.
And I have him here primarily because I just didn't think I could do this myself. And I wanna start with why we're doing this, because I think a lot of people are probably like, oh, why in the world, just 3 days after you lost your daughter, are you recording a podcast? It's a good question. Well, I mean, one part of it is I just released her birth story, and obviously, one option would be to delete that podcast, but that feels really wrong. And it doesn't feel fair to her. It just, I can't and don't want to erase any part of her life. And I've been talking about her and our journey since we found out we were pregnant. And this is one of those things that's really interesting. I remember going through some tough personal stuff a few years back and feeling like it was hard to talk about it publicly, but that's also the business that I'm in, you know? So it didn't feel right to either of us to delete her birth story podcast. And even if we had, you know, we had been talking about this pregnancy and transitioning to motherhood for 10 months. And, I also worked my butt off to get a few months ahead. And so the next 3 months of podcasts were all recorded pregnant, anticipating having our baby here right now. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, you know, there is nothing we could do or say that will make this harder. So recording this sucks, but it also doesn't make our loss harder. Would you agree with that, Chris?
Absolutely.
There's no conversation that we could have. There's nothing that we could share or not share that makes this harder. It doesn't make it easier either. I don't think anything will make it easier. But for those of you who are listening, we're doing this because we've been sharing from the start, because we don't want to delete her birth story podcast, because we also just don't want to have that open loop out there. There are a lot of people who listen to the podcast who don't follow on social media, and so there are a lot of people who don't know that we lost her. So, and then lastly, the other piece of it is I'm a business owner, and you know, no matter what happens, whether it's coronavirus related or it's losing a child or it's getting sick, like you got to keep the lights on, you know, things that could make a really awful traumatic situation worse are like going out of business. Not that, you know, Primal Potential is going to go out of business, but the reason that companies don't go out of business in tragedy is because people keep working, you know? And so, you know, for all of those who are like, hey, take your time, you know, do what you need to do, there is also a reality that I am a small business owner. And as a small business owner, you don't get to turn off, you don't get to shut down. So there are a lot of reasons that we are doing this, and I just want to reiterate that this might not be an episode that everybody needs to listen to or everybody should listen to. There's no way for us to have this be polished or pretty or easy. It won't be any of those things, but what it is real. And we're sitting in my office right now, and I think it was just 6 days ago that you were inside with her, Chris, and she was sleeping, and I was out here recording her birth story, which I was so excited to do. And while I was doing it, I was also thinking every second, like, did she wake up? You know, like, where is she sleeping? Is she sleeping on you? Is she sleeping in her boppy? Is she sleeping in the bassinet? And it feels like an unimaginable nightmare that we are sitting here 6 days later having this conversation. But before we talk, you know, obviously a lot of people, and thank you everyone who has sent prayers and condolences. I know people are wondering what happened. Factor us into that as well. We are right there with you wondering what the hell happened. But before we kind of talk about some of that, and we won't share all of that, but we will definitely share some of it. I want to talk a little about her, because the Birth Story podcast was really to talk about, you know, how she came into this world. And much of that was about before she arrived and my fever and all of that. And I'm sure a lot of you are wondering, did that have something to do with her passing? And the answer is, we don't know. I wish we knew, but that's kind of where you're at too, Chris, right? Like, we don't know.
Yeah, there's just so much that's still open.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of answers. But I know in the birth story, I talked a lot about, you know, the medications that I was taking prior to her delivery, like in the hospital, Pitocin and the Cervidil and, you know, antibiotics and different things like that, and the C-section. But we didn't really talk about our baby Dagny. She made an impact on everybody. And the nurses and the doctors, you know, they see babies every day. But there was something about our girl that captivated people. And you felt that too. We felt this isn't just like a reflective, retrospective kind of, you know, nicety. It was very real in the hospital that everyone was like, oh my gosh, what a good baby. Right?
Yeah, they seemed gravitated towards her.
Yeah.
You know, the nurses and everything after she was born in the hospital, and they would just come in and hang out.
They'd hold her and look at her, and they would comment on like her physical strength. Like, so many people commented on her physical strength. Like, they do this test in the pediatrician's office where they take a bit, you know, the doctor will put his two fingers in, one in each of her hands, and, kind of like pull her up a little bit to see her head drop back. And our girl, she held her head up. Like, she like pulled herself. The doctor was like, did you see that? She literally like pulled herself up and she held her head up. And that was the day after we left the hospital. So she was 5 days old at that point. Yeah, she was 5 days old. That was on Wednesday. She was born on Friday. She was super strong. I mean, when nurses would test her like suck reflex with their finger, she was so strong. She broke blood vessels in my finger on her first car ride because she was just like sucking so hard. She was just like, and when you would have her on your chest, she could just hold her head up and look at you, especially when you would sing. She would just hold her head up and she would just look at you.
Yeah. Almost like she was in the front leaning rest position.
One thing you said, I think when we were meeting with the priest the other day to arrange her services, that she was comfortable with everybody.
Yeah. A lot of babies, you know, when they get to passed around, they'll cry or
even just in general
show discomfort. And that's not something she ever did.
No.
She was comfortable everywhere with everyone.
Yeah.
Like
immediately just at ease, whether it was either one of us or it was your brother or it was my sister or my mom or the nurses or even like when they came into the room to do her heel pricks and they said, oh, I'm sorry, babies hate this. And she didn't fuss.
No,
she didn't. She would make a mean mug. Oh, she would give you the stare down to let you know, like, you know, you're aggravating me. But she was just strong.
Mm-hmm. She definitely handled needles better than her mother and I.
Yeah, I know, because Chris and I both, like, are just weak when it comes to needles. Like, pass out, cry kind of weak. And our girl, nope, she was strong. She was strong. Even the second that she was born, we had one or two cries. And then she was calm, like super calm. And then they, you know, did a bunch of little tests in the operating room after the C-section. She was just chill. She came over. You brought her over to me within minutes of her being born. And there's two pictures of this. We shared one of them that looks like she's kissing me. But the second one that we haven't shared, she actually is kissing me. She's like licking me. She's
licking her.
Yeah, she's licking me. She didn't cry. Her eyes were open. A lot of C-section babies are a little bit more drowsy, especially because I was pretty heavily medicated before she was born. She was alert, you know? She was alert, and she was just settled so quickly. You know, even if we were changing her and she might start to, like, fuss or whatever, if she heard our voice or we put our hand on her, she would settle right away. She just was so content. And I guess that's been one of, like, my big things in the few days that we've been walking through this nightmare is our girl was healthy and she was strong and we had no idea that we were headed for this. And I know you said somebody came by the other night to bring us a meal and you said, you know, the hardest part is just we did not see this coming at all, right? The day, the Wednesday, which was the 18th, the 18th of March, she had a regular pediatrician appointment that was 1 week after her first pediatrician appointment. So her first pediatrician appointment was the day after we were released from the hospital. And then they said, you know, come back in 1 week. And her weight was down further on the 18th. But our pediatrician was not concerned about that. He had the sense that we could just feed her more often. And that was really his takeaway. Like, hey guys, just try getting her to eat every 90 minutes instead of letting her sleep a couple hours. You know, just be really diligent about that for the next couple weeks so that we can get some weight on her. The only thing that we had noticed, and we noticed it that morning, the morning of the 18th, in the overnight, that she just wasn't as interested in eating. But that was all we noticed. She wasn't fussy. She wasn't discolored. It was the only concern that we had was that she didn't seem to have much of an appetite that morning. Not like for days, not for weeks, that overnight. And we were like, well, good thing we're going to see the pediatrician, right?
Yeah.
And our pediatrician on Wednesday, and it's, there are no words, and I won't even try to describe the complexity that has been added and the additional struggle and challenge and heartbreak that has been added because of all of these restrictions. But when we brought her into that appointment, we weren't both able to go back. I went back with her, and Chris stayed in the waiting room, and we were, you know, not super happy about that because when you have a newborn baby and we both had questions, we certainly wanted to both be back there, but that wasn't an option. And the pediatrician literally just said, bring her back on Monday. This was on Wednesday the 18th. And I said, that feels like too far out. And the reason I said that was because her weight was still going down. Like if her weight had stabilized, if her weight had gone up, I would have been totally fine waiting until Monday. But I just said, I feel like Monday is too far out. And he said, okay, come back on Friday. So we left the pediatrician on Wednesday the 18th. And I said to Chris, you know, he said, feed her every 90 minutes and come back on Friday. And you were irritated. You were irritated because you were like, well, she doesn't want to eat. It's not a matter of like, oh, just feed her more frequently. You were like, since, you know, the middle of the night or early this morning, she hasn't wanted to eat. So it's, we can wake her up every 5 minutes, but if she doesn't want to eat, that doesn't help. Right. And so we were in the middle of that conversation. When the doctor called back, our pediatrician called us, we were in the car, we were driving. We stayed in the parking lot for a while cause I was trying to nurse her in the back seat. But we were driving home and the pediatrician said, you know what? She might be dehydrated. So when you get home, try to give her 2.5 ounces of expressed milk. And, you know, if you can get her to eat that, great. I'll see you on Friday. If you can't, take her to her nearest pediatric ER, which sounds alarmist, but that's just where you take newborn babies, right? You can't take them back to maternity. You can't take them back to, you know, where you had the baby. You have to go to a pediatric ER, which was like, it felt scary, but we didn't think we were looking at anything scary. And that was, about an hour away from where we live. There isn't a pediatric ER on Cape Cod where we live. So we went home and I pumped. Yeah. And we had about 2.5 ounces and we went to the store and Chris bought a million different nipples. Cause we thought, you know, maybe if we try in a bottle with a different nipple, and we had to do it in a bottle expressed milk so that we knew exactly how much she was getting. And, you know, I said, get every nipple that you can get and see if that makes a difference. And so, she was eating. We probably got her to take almost 2 of the 2.5 ounces, right?
Yeah, I would say close to that.
And so part of us was like, maybe it's nothing, right? Like maybe we just need to give it a little time and she's tired and maybe she's got a little bug. But like it wasn't like we pumped 2.5 ounces and she wouldn't take any of it. We were close to that 2.5 and we were literally debating with each other, do we go to the pediatric ER? Do we not? Thank God we did. But even when we got there, their sense was that she was just dehydrated and had low blood sugar, likely because she was just about 12 hours behind on her feeds because she hadn't eaten well that day. She wasn't days behind or anything like that. It had just been a few hours of not getting normal nutrition. And they checked her blood sugar. It was low. So they said, perfect. We're just going to top you off with fluids. I remember them saying that. You're just here for a top off. We're going to get some fluids into her. We'll monitor her overnight to make sure that her drive to eat comes back. And you guys will be good to go in the morning, right?
Yep.
And they, because they were going to keep her, couldn't stay in the ER, they admitted her. And I was stressed. I was worried because you don't want your baby to be in the hospital for a minute for a small issue or a big issue. But neither one of us even in our wildest imagination could have thought that we were headed down this road, right? I mean, you were very chill.
Yeah, I mean, try to maintain a level head through everything and trust in the doctors and nurses, so.
So they brought us up to a pediatric room. And with their precautions, they had said only one parent could stay overnight. And I kind of threw the new mom nutty. I wasn't feeling well. And we thought that it might have just been like sleep deprivation. I stayed up with her every night. Before this, I I didn't want to be away from her. And I had a C-section, so I couldn't quickly get up, sit up, to look into the bassinet. And I'm a much lighter sleeper than Chris even normally, and then even more so after having her. And so I sat with her in a chair. She was laying in her boppy right next to me every single night that we were home, because I couldn't get up quick enough. And I just wanted to be able to turn my head and see her and know that she was okay. So when we were in that peds room, I was really not feeling well, and I was bleeding a lot, which is, you know, part of C-section recovery, but my bleeding had intensified and my clotting had intensified, and I had like a debilitating headache. And so the nurse and the doctor both said, "Mom, you need to get some sleep, and we're going to take care of your baby." And logically, it made a lot of sense, I think, to both of us, you know, for my milk supply, for my own physical healing. I was in the room. But yeah, when they said Chris had to leave, I was like, no, I don't feel well. This is our baby. You cannot tell me that he has to go. And they were really, thank God, very gracious and let you stay in the room. So we were both there. You were on one side of her. I was on the other side of her. She was in like a, kind of like a crib. And even in that ward, their sense was very much the same, that she was dehydrated. They had her on IV fluids and dextrose. Her blood sugar was coming up. And they felt like maybe she had a little stomach bug, but that the drive to eat thing was just a factor of, you know, they kept saying like, you know how it is, if you get really dehydrated, you know, you just feel more lethargic. And when you feel lethargic, you don't want to eat. And that was, that's where we were at, right?
Yeah. They had us pretty well convinced that it's a very normal thing when you're low on fuel.
Yeah. So I was, I mean, sleeping, but constantly, I mean, every time she made a noise, I was like, Chris, because he was a couple feet closer to her than I was. There was another infant bed between me and Dagny, and Chris was right next to her. That's kind of when everything changed. So she was spitting up, which isn't something she had done at home. But the nurse in the room, who was in there almost constantly, like if she had to have been in there every 10 minutes or so. She was not ever gone for long, but her sense was, it sounds like she just has an upset tummy, you know, and she's just a little gaggy. But the nurse really wasn't concerned about that at all. And I guess I want to say here that Chris and I replay every second of her life in our minds. Every minute of the day, we not only think about how she came into this world, we think about everything that happened leading up to her leaving this world. And so I think it's very easy and very natural to start to question yourself. We know that it really doesn't matter. But as she was kind of spinning up, I kept saying like, that's, you know, that's not normal. Like, why is she doing that? But the nurse and the doctor were just very unfazed by it and just kept saying like, yeah, she's a little gaggy, but just, you know, she just seems like she's having a hard time getting comfortable. A little stomach bug, and they were testing her for, they were doing some cultures to see if she had a bacterial infection, right?
Yeah.
The gagging kind of got a little bit more frequent, and they decided to take her down for an x-ray to see if there was an intestinal blockage, and Chris went down for that with her. She was never alone. And they thought they saw an intestinal blockage. Mm-hmm. So they came back up to the room, and everything from that point is just like a blur of, it felt like 10 years and it felt like 10 seconds. They said, we're going to transport you via ambulance to Boston Children's Hospital. Even then, I was like, okay, an intestinal blockage. She's not a preemie. She's a good, healthy weight. She's a healthy girl. Like, that'll suck. And I don't want my baby to go through surgery. But like, I was definitely not thinking that this could be fatal. And I don't think anybody else was either.
No.
But it was emotional and it was scary. And some in the time between them telling us that we were going to go to Children's and getting her in the ambulance, she just really started to struggle. And her blood pressure was dropping. They had to intubate her. She wasn't able to breathe well on her own. So for those of you who aren't familiar with kind of the lingo with the intubation, they were putting a tube down her throat so that she could get oxygen throughout her body and not have to breathe on her own. It was at that point that her belly became noticeably distended, not something we had ever seen. There had been no bloating or distension prior to that. It all happened in those moments very quickly with Chris and I in the room. And I remember thinking, like, this is just awful to see and to be here for and to not be able to touch her or hold her or, like, comfort her. And I had no idea how much worse it was going to get. It seemed to take a long time for them to stabilize her, to get her in the ambulance. Like, I have no sense, but, like, I feel like it was hours.
Felt like hours.
I think it actually was hours, because it was early in the morning that they made that determination, and we didn't get to Boston Children's until about 9 a.m. So they had to do a lot. They were changing her meds. They were giving her dopamine to increase her blood pressure to make sure that she was getting oxygen throughout her body. And we just stood there holding each other. I don't even know how to describe it, but I can say that it only got exponentially worse from there. Once they were able to stabilize her, they took us to the ambulance, and Chris was going to follow in the car. I was in the front of the ambulance with the driver, and even just getting out of the hospital to the ambulance was torture and traumatic. But even then, with everything that was happening, I was thinking, our baby's going to have surgery and this is terrifying, but I was not ever thinking we would lose her.
Right.
So I got in the ambulance. I wish I could find our driver, Joe.
Joe was amazing.
He was an angel. Like, I believe that he was, I don't know, he was an angel. And I was in the front with him, and there was a neonatologist in the back. There was a respiratory therapist in the back. There was a nurse in the back. And then there was another ambulance technician in the back. So four adults and Dagny in the back. Me and the driver, Joe, with Chris following behind. And Joe said to me, well, first he said, tell me about your daughter. Even before that, I remember asking in that room, is she going to be okay? Do you remember what they said?
No.
They said she's very, very sick. And I was gutted by that. Like, the only answer I expected was, yes, she's going to be fine. We're getting her to great care. And the tenor of the conversation was very much the same with Joe. he was so kind, the ambulance driver, and he said, tell me about your girl. And I told him a little, and I was sobbing. And he said, things are going to go really fast once we get to the hospital. They're going to take her right to the OR. And he said, if they're able to save her, this is going to be a very long road. You are going to drive these roads many times. You're going to have a very long stay at Children's. And I was thinking, okay, we can do that. I can work from anywhere. We'll get a hotel. We'll get an Airbnb. We'll get an apartment. We'll, you know, okay. Like, it was horrifying, but in my mind, I'm thinking, people do this. We'll bring her back to health, and we'll find a way. A couple of times along the ride, somebody in the back would say to me, you know, she's being really strong. Like, and I thought, great, good. She's stable. That's where my head was. She's stable. And then we got there, and they radioed in, and they said, is there a parent in the ambulance? And Joe said, yes, there is. And that was just for consent. So that didn't really alarm me. They wanted to make sure that we could give whatever consent we needed, you know, prior to them taking her to the operating room. And I was just thinking, like, okay, either there's a blockage in her intestines, or maybe there's like some torsion, like her intestines have kind of like knotted up and twisted over each other. They'll fix it. Then we'll be recovering from abdominal surgery. Won't be easy. She's a baby, but like, okay, we've got this, right? Is that kind of what you were thinking?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So Chris and I have talked about, you know, what we want to share and what we're not as comfortable sharing. And the Children's Hospital side of the journey is dark and trauma that I never could have imagined for our girl and for us and for our families. So ultimately, you know, there's still a lot we don't know, and maybe in time we will feel like we want to share more, or it will make sense to share more. But just know that if you're left going like, oh, you know, there's missing pieces, there are missing pieces. There are missing pieces for things that we don't feel it's in good taste to share. And there are missing pieces because there's things we don't know about what happened. But what we can share, what we will share, is that as soon as, you know, I got out of the ambulance, they got her out of the ambulance very quickly. They took her immediately to the operating room, and they took me to a small conference room just down the hall from the operating room. And Chris was not there yet. He, I think I had texted you when we got there, and I think you had said you were like 9 minutes out or something like that.
Exactly.
I was sitting in this little conference room with a doctor who was kind of going over what was happening as they were prepping her for surgery. I couldn't have been in that little conference room for more than a minute before Joe, the ambulance driver, and somebody else from Boston Children's who was in scrubs, just threw open the door and said, we need mom. And this was on Thursday morning.
Yep.
They said, we're losing her. We need mom. Now I'm there 13 days out from a C-section. Like, I can't really walk quickly. And Joe had me by the hand, and we ran to the OR. I'm in my regular clothes. I was in what I had slept in the night before. I looked like death. And yet I walked right into this sterile operating room with, no lie, 30 people in there in scrubs, just a team of doctors and anesthesiologists and nurses and respiratory therapists and you name it. It was a large room and I had no idea what I was doing there. And they pulled like a captain's chair forward towards the table where she was. And someone said, "Mom, you need to be here." And someone else said, "Why do we have a parent here? Why is there a parent here?" And I understand their concern was like, this is a sterile environment. Why the hell did you just bring, you know, mom in with no mask and no covering on her shoes and no gown and no nothing? I have no idea how long I was in that room. And I couldn't see a whole lot. I could see her. But there was 30 people in there and it was just chaos. And they quickly removed me and decided it wasn't a good idea. And they were walking me back to the conference room when you came in. And we didn't get to the conference room before they did it again, right?
No, we did get into the little room.
We did?
Yep.
And somebody came in again?
Yep, and grabbed us and ran us down the hallway.
Do you remember what they said?
That they're losing her. And they wanted us in the operating room, and we got down to the operating section, but not quite to the room, and they stopped us, and they sent us back again.
And you were not okay right there.
No. No, I was feeling everything in me drop.
Yeah, you were about to collapse on the floor. And there was a woman who had been with us at the children's hospital who came in the transport ambulance. And she said, "We can't keep doing this to these people. We need to get them a place to sit down." Because we had no idea. We had no clue we were in a catastrophic situation.
No.
And even that, as traumatizing as that was nothing compared to what we went through later that day and on Friday. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that.
So what happened that we understand is that her heart failed within a minute of getting to Boston Children's. So if we had been a minute later leaving Weymouth, she would have died in the ambulance. Her heart failed and they were able to do chest compressions for 30 minutes. And that's how long it took them to get her on heart-lung bypass. So that machines were doing the work of her heart and her lungs. And essentially what we were told is this is going to buy us some time. This is going to buy us some time to figure out what's going on and hopefully heal her. Once she was on bypass, they did open up her belly. And there was no blockage, but her spleen and her liver were inflamed to the point where they were not able to close her back up. So they put a little dome over her intestines. And our hope was that we would figure out whatever was causing that inflammation, whether it was viral or we had no idea. And the surgeon said, you know, bypass, people respond really well. Like it could be a day or two on bypass. Just, you know, and then she could respond very quickly to medications and we could be in a good place. That's not what happened. She did come out of surgery and they brought her upstairs to the ICU. We waited hours, like a lot of hours. A
whole lot of hours.
They sent us a chaplain. my mom and my sister, my mom's husband, were able to come.
I don't think we saw her until about 5 p.m.
Yeah, it was a long, long, long wait. And what I will say is when we saw her,
it was tough. It was jarring because
didn't look like her.
No, I mean,
but she was still with us, and we were still hopeful, and we had
the best doctors in the world working on her,
and the whole world praying for her.
Yeah, everyone from California to Uganda, Germany, people all around the world.
And the doctor's sense at that point was okay. We're going to just treat this very, very broadly, and we are going to, you know, pray that, you know, the swelling comes down in her spleen and her liver. And we were just believing that that was going to happen. Like, even at that point, we understood that things were critical at that point. And the doctors were very straightforward with us about that. And they did not appear hopeful when we first saw her. It was just Chris and I, and we went back there. And we both fell apart pretty hard. And I just remember, I don't know, I felt like I was screaming. But I said, like, someone tell us something good. Someone tell us something good. Someone tell us something good. And no one said anything. Like, do you remember that? Like the silence to me was deafening. Like, it terrified me.
It might have been 15 seconds of silence, but it felt like 5 minutes.
Nobody said anything. And then somebody said, like, well, we were able to get her on bypass. Which, you know, like, well, yeah, if you hadn't, she wouldn't be here right now. So we stayed with her, and we talked to her, and we sang to her, and we prayed over her, and we, you know, did everything we could to be close to her, and we sobbed and we cried and we begged for miracles, and we kind of, you know, realized that there wasn't really, you know, we needed to give the doctors room to care for her. And so it's weird, like, you hear stories about people who have children who are in a dire situation. And, like, I don't know, I thought that they might have, like, a parent's room, or that, you know, somebody would come and take us someplace or whatever. But it was kind of like, so there are hotels nearby. And so we, you know, called a hotel and we made a reservation and we walked over there and we sat down. I pumped because, you know, meanwhile, like, my breasts are still full of milk. I had been, you know, feeding my girl constantly for 2 weeks. We got something to eat, and then we walked back over to the hospital. It was just so painful to be without her and to not be able to, like, see her, even though it was also, for me, really painful to see her like that. You seem to be a lot stronger, but it was still pretty awful.
Yeah, I mean, there's no easy way to see your child in a hospital connected to a machine that's doing most of her body's work.
And she just visibly had changed dramatically.
She was pumped full of fluid, so.
I don't want to leave it at that. So we went back over. We spent some time with her. Same thing. There was a lot of crying, a lot of sobbing, a lot of begging, a lot of praying. But we sang to her and we touched her. And we felt hopeful because by that point they had her hooked up to an EEG monitoring her brain. Because one of the concerns was that with 30 minutes on, with 30 minutes of resuscitation efforts, that she might be brain dead. But it seemed like her brain was reacting to our voice. And, you know, there was definite activity there. And so we went back to our hotel that night, hopeful, like deeply fearful and emotional and exhausted and terrified and all of these things. But also, I think we were both still hoping that you know, she was going to pull through and we were going to wake up in the morning and it was going to be a new day and it was going to be a day of miracles. Right? Like, that's kind of where we were at.
Yeah. Yeah. We went hoping we could get a little bit of sleep. And then after a few hours, we were able to see a positive change and we'd be going back to a miracle.
Right.
Or another miracle, because she was a miracle, and getting to the hospital in time was a miracle. So we're hoping it was just a house of cards of miracles just falling in order.
Right. So the next morning, I had to pump, which was emotional and hard. But, you know, Chris kept saying, like, you're doing this because we're bringing our girl home, you know, and we need you to still be able to, you know, take care of our girl. And we went up to the unit, and on Thursday, they had just always let us right back. Like, you're the parents, go right back. In fact, we didn't even need permission. We could just swipe our access cards, and we were able to go back. But the guy at the desk stopped us and said, wait a second, I have to call the doctors first, and then told us to go to the waiting room. And even then, we were like, well, it's probably because they're rounding, because it was around the time of day where the doctors do their rounds and it's shift change. So it could just be that they don't want parents back there during shift change. And I was definitely concerned that they wouldn't let us right back. But I also felt like it made sense that, you know, shift change, right?
Right.
So we probably waited
10, 15 minutes.
I don't know. And then her surgeon and the neonatologist came out. Nobody was there with us yet. My mom was downstairs getting a new badge. My sister was on her way. My mom's husband, I think, was on his way. So it was just Chris and I. And they basically said, she's still alive, but it's over. Right?
Yeah. They said...
her organ systems were failing.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't able to process lactic acid. That had been building up overnight, and
it killed her.
With her body not being able to process it, and oxygen is what processes it. So oxygen going through the muscles wasn't happening. The body stopped metabolizing. So her other organs started to shut down, and
they told us that because of bypass, we had some time, that essentially she was mechanically with us. So we had time to baptize her. They wanted to give us time to coordinate holding her, which was complicated because she was on bypass. So at that point, we wanted our families to be there to say goodbye to her and to be there for her baptism. Fortunately, my mom and Bob and my sister were all really close by, but my sister is her godmother. Chris's uncle is her godfather. We wanted them there. So we just started making phone calls, but I was still making pleas for a miracle. I think you were too. Like, mm-hmm. And I was on my knees at her bedside begging for a miracle, like begging for a miracle. But I guess at this point, you know, to kind of not go through, some of the darkest parts of the journey, we'll just share that we were able to be holding her as she was baptized and confirmed, and it was a family priest who came down. We were able to sing to her, we were able to talk to her about what we wanted for her life. We spent a lot of time with her alone. We had family there that was there to say goodbye to her. we are hopeful that we will get some answers so that we can understand what happened. Right now, we don't have those answers, but we do have an incredible team that is, even after her passing, at Boston Children's trying to get us some answers. You know, I was thinking about, like, it's so early. It's so early in this process. This is all so fresh. I was trying to think of, like, if there's anything I can think of that this has changed in me. And the first thing that comes to mind is just that I just feel heartbroken beyond measure, and like I'll never be the same, and I know I never will be the same, you know, and I don't think anybody is the same after losing a child. It's been interesting and complicated to walk through this in the midst of government shutdown, crazy coronavirus restrictions. I will say that I haven't been on social media very much at all. It's just hard and painful. And, but I do see a lot of parents, you know, complaining about having their kids home. And I understand, like, that's their context, right? They don't have our context of just having walked this with our baby. But I will say that, it changes your perspective on everything. And I know that a lot of people listening are hurting and their worlds are turned upside down because their kids are home or their jobs are uncertain. And hey, like, I'm a small business owner. I feel this coronavirus stuff very, very personally too. But I will say that I would give anything. I would give my very own life to have the gift of our daughter crying, taking our attention, taking our time, giving us sleepless nights, you know? And I don't expect everybody else to have that context, you know? I can't put that on anybody else, but I don't know, Chris, where are you at? Like, do you feel like it has changed you in a way you can articulate? Is it too soon?
I think every little thing becomes an emergency based on how small, like to us, based on how small her symptoms were, what little had changed in her before everything went bad. But I gotta say, on the strength of her, her face was calm the whole time.
Yeah.
She never freaked out.
No.
Even as they got ready to intubate her, her eyes seemed calm. I mean, she wasn't crying. There was nothing other than
what was happening around us.
Yeah, nothing but what was happening around us to let us know there was something major going on.
We had a long drive home from the hospital on Friday. We were like, do we want to go home? Do we want to stay? We knew we didn't want to stay in the hotel we had stayed in the night before. And at first we thought we didn't want to go home because, of course, we left home thinking we were just going for some fluids and we'd be right back. We didn't want anybody else to come into the house and pack things up. And we ultimately decided to go home, that, you know, seeing her bassinet or her bobby or her clothes or her diapers, none of it's going to make it harder. There's nothing that can make this harder. Just like there's nothing that can make it easier. So we decided we were going to go home. We took our time. And one of the things we talked about was how, like, we would love to support other families who, unfortunately, will walk this path in the little things, right? Like, it would have been amazing. There was a social worker for Children's who was great and just emotionally very supportive. But, like, if she had come up to us and said, hey, listen, we've got your hotel arrangements squared away. This is where you'll be staying. This other family has gifted this to you. Or if she had said, you know, hey, here's a $100 voucher for the cafeteria. You don't have to worry about anything. Because it's those little things that's like the last thing that you want to mess with. And so while it will certainly take us, you know, a few weeks to get our feet on the ground, one thing that we decided the very day we lost her that we would do to honor her is show her strength and her light and her impact to other families who are navigating either infant crisis or infant loss. And, you know, while I would give anything to not be going through this, given that we have to, given that we're here, given that this is unchangeable, it will be as close to healing as it can possibly be to call the social worker from Children's and say, you know, we have these funds set aside in her name and we would like to work with you to give them to families who show up so unexpectedly like we did, so that we can take care of their room, so that we can take care of their food and little things like
help take off little stresses that don't need to be added on.
Right. And I mean, even my mother works for the church, and so we have had so much support in the logistics of like, how do we transport her body from the hospital and who do we contact for this? And what are the steps of planning a funeral, which feels just unimaginable. But we've said several times, like, we can't imagine if we didn't have the experience of my mom and her resources with the church to do that. And so to be able to go to a family that is walking this and say, hey, we have, you know, prepared these resources for you and we've already answered these questions that you might have, and you can, you know, because literally we left there with a parking pass. That was it. And don't get me wrong, Boston Children's is an amazing organization and their priority is to take care of their patients. But on the other side of that are the families. And to walk out without your child in the throes of unimaginable grief with a valet sticker, it's so incomplete. And we have established the Dagny Elizabeth Thompson Memorial Fund so that in her honor we can provide resources and support to any family who is walking this, whether they lose their child or whether they're fortunate enough to avoid that outcome. I know some of you have seen that on social media and many of you have been very generous in your donations, but you can go to primalpotential.com/Dagny, D-A-G-N-Y. A lot of people have gotten that wrong. primalpotential.com/Dagny, D as in dog, A-G-N-Y. And there will be a couple things there. There will be a link if you wish to support that initiative that we want to carry forward in her honor to support other families. There's also going to be a place where you can put in your email address. One of the things that I do for my clients is I share daily coaching audios, just short 1 to 3 minute messages every day to kind of get your head in the right place for creating a good, productive, healthy, happy life. And moving forward, these are messages and tools that we want to be able to share with everybody. And so if you're interested in, they're sent via text message right to your phone, short little 1 to 3 minute audio messages. If you want to learn more about those and participating in those, you'll also be able to do that at primalpotential.com/Dagny, D as in dog, A-G-N-Y. And if you have any questions about it, you can email Sarah@primalpotential.com or Susie@primalpotential.com. You know, I'm still here. I'm still in the business every day. In large part because what else would I do? You know, you can't just sit and look at the walls all day. And also because as a business owner, that's just the reality of life, no matter what is going on. Where do we go from here, Chris?
Healing. What we can. Leaning on each other. Accepting help from our friends and family.
For people listening who are wondering like what they can do for us, like I just have such a hard time with that because I feel like nothing helps. What are your thoughts?
I mean, nothing, there's no ask. Show appreciation for what you have.
Yeah.
It's the big thing.
Yeah. So much of what we worry about, so much of what we stress about, so much of what we think about really doesn't matter. You know, at the end of the day, if you don't have your health, you don't have anything at all. And if you don't have the people you love, the stuff you do have doesn't matter at all. So I would just kind of wrap this up by saying, stop waiting to take care of your health because it can go quickly. And if you don't have it, you don't have anything. And be better to the people that you love. I've been as guilty of this as anybody of letting small things that don't matter create conflict and tension. And it just doesn't matter. Love people better. Be kinder. It's all there is, you know? Anything else you want to say, Chris, or anything else you want to say about Dagny?
No, I think you said it all pretty well.
Well, I want to publicly thank you, Chris, because, you know, I thought a lot about when I was pregnant. I know a lot of men have trouble connecting to newborns because they don't really do anything and they just kind of sleep and that's really all they do. And I wasn't sure, like, how you would connect to her. For moms, you know, we have that, we have 9 or 10 months to connect to our babies. You connected with her deeply and instantly, and you took incredible care of her and incredible care of me 24 hours a day. And, you know, that wasn't just when things got scary, like when we were home, you took care of us without complaint, whether it was me waking you up at 3 a.m. to move the ottoman because I couldn't move it myself, or, you know, Chris would sit and help me nurse, like literally more often than not, it was, you know, all hands on deck between Dagny and getting her arms out of the way and getting her to latch and getting her mouth in the right position and getting my breast in the right position. And, Chris was a part of that in every moment, and, holding her and loving her and singing to her. And, I think the only video that I got of her was driving to our first pediatrician's appointment, and the second we got in the car, Chris said to his phone, like, kids music or infant songs or something like that, and something came on, and you referred to the band, and you were like, I saw these guys when I was like 4 years old, and I was in the back seat with Dagny, and Chris was in the front seat singing this ridiculous Emmett song and dancing too, like bopping his head and everything. And it was just like the cutest, sweetest thing. And you never know. We always joke that like I can't handle like illness and injury at all, except it's not a joke because like I don't have the skills for that. And I was thrown into the deep end in that regard in the last few days. And Chris picked me up off the floor, literally. And you were such a rock for her. And you were so strong, and you showed so much love and so much devotion and so much care for her and for me. And so I just publicly want to say thank you for being so strong.
Thank you.
I was going to say, you can say you're welcome.
Thank you. That's one of those things. It's hard to say you're welcome for that, because it's what I'm here for. We're a team.
It's been ugly, but...
And if I say you're welcome, I'm going to sing it.
Okay.
Yeah, like The Rock. So it'll be bad.
Okay. So yeah, I am sorry to have to release this episode, and I know that it was hard, but I know you guys have been along for the journey, and it definitely doesn't make it harder to share. I don't think anything can make this harder. You can learn more about the Dagny Elizabeth Thompson Memorial Fund at primalpotential.com/Dagny, D as in dog, A-G-N-Y. And also there will be some information, or at least an availability to get on a waiting or information list for these short daily coaching audios that will not only be my thoughts on growth tools for you, but quite frankly, it's going to be about the messages I'm sending to myself to heal, and the coping tools and strategies that I'm using for myself to heal. So you can head over to primalpotential.com/Dagny, and thank you for all your prayers. Keep them coming. I know we have a long road ahead. I think the only thing to kind of conclude with is just how much we loved her.
Yeah.
I just love her so much. Just love her endlessly. And thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks, Chris, for doing this with me.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Primal Potential Podcast, where our goal is not to help you learn. Our goal is to help you change. This is a year of action. Take something you learned from this episode and put it into action in your life today. To learn more about working more closely with me and the Primal Potential team, please visit primalpotential.com/transform.